So hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. I'm Stephanie Domingo.
And I'm Tux Lerzel.
I come to you from Bogota, Colombia, where I am recording on land belonging to the Muisca peoples.
I am coming to you from Detroit, Michigan, where I record on land belonging to the Ojibwe, Ottawa, Potawatomi, and Wyandot nations.
These nations are just some of many still very much out there doing their thing, and we'd like to acknowledge that.
Heck yes.
This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. We be drinking and we be swearing. And we be joined by some very special guests. We have Rachel and Leah from Hashtag History. You know them. You love them. If you know what's good for you, you love them. you've heard their promo on our show several many times. For those who don't know, and shame on you, but you know, here you go. Hashtag History is a podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike, where each week they dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption. Not only do they cover some super interesting topics on their show, we were so charmed and so grateful to be their first like podcast friends. They started a little bit after us, but we became fast friends. And we recently, very recently, appeared as guests on their season finale. So they're on our show right now. And we're so thankful to have them here. Would you two like to just take a minute to talk a little bit about yourselves and your podcast?
Sure.
Tell our listeners a little bit about y'all.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Leah.
And I'm Rachel.
And we are a podcast from Sacramento, California, and I love that you guys do land acknowledgments. So the greater Sacramento area is on land that belongs to the Miwok, Maidu, and Nisenan people. So shout out to them.
I
think that's just so cool that you guys do that. So thank you.
Yeah, I love that you do that. Thank you so much for having us on the show. I mean, our listeners have heard a million zillion times how much we adore you both. So we are likewise charmed to have the opportunity to come on your show. And yeah, like you said, Stephanie, we're just a weekly history podcast that covers all things controversy, corruption. We cover all areas of history, but we tend to lean more towards American only because, as I know you two are very familiar, there's a lot of corruption to talk about there.
So yes,
a lot of our is
and some of those topics we've covered, things like Chappaquiddick. That's one of our favorite ones,
one of the very first ones, right?
It was the very first one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
we do not recommend people go back and listen to it because
we even re-recorded that those episodes because we're embarrassed.
Yeah. We're ashamed, in fact. So do us all a favor and don't listen to the first episode. Trust
hey,
it was great.
Everyone has to start somewhere.
It's a journey that you know, our show is like that too. I think, was it our second or third episode?
We got so drunk
that the initial recording that we sent to Tim was 4 hours long.
Oh my gosh. I would die. The horror.
That sounds amazing, though. That sounds like such a great time. I would say hours, we don't go quite that long when we get a little tipsy, but I can tell when we're a little more tipsy because Leah does all the editing and we throw bloopers at the end of our show.
Yes.
And sometimes the blooper section is like 5 minutes long. Like, oh my God, how bad did we get? But yeah, so we cover all kinds of topics. A couple other ones in there. We've covered the Salem witch trials. We've covered Jack the Ripper. We've done the racist history of the state of Oregon. We've even done the history of Disneyland because, of course, there's corruption there too, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everywhere you look.
Everywhere you look.
Yeah. And then much like you all, but not quite on your level, Tux, we also do weekly cocktail segments that we try to tie to the topic we're discussing on each episode. So like, for example, the Titanic episode, we drank a concoction called the Iceberg. Or for the
it
episode.
Was great.
Yeah.
speaking of bloopers, drunk bloopers
that was a bad one
with the Titanic episode. I distinctly remember that.
Yeah. There was like an episode where we dove into like historic torture techniques. Super fun episode where we drink an Iron Maiden cocktail. So yeah, we try to have fun with it. Usually we go pretty literal with our cocktails.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love the way you guys do the themed cocktails. It's super fun. I feel like there's definitely different ways of going about it. And like, I feel like sometimes, even though I'm just trying to immerse us in the time period, a lot of times I feel like ours aren't like specific enough to the story. Yeah. So I like that they're themed to the actual story.
I feel like we do almost the opposite of that, where it's generally more literal. I would say like 90% of our cocktails are. And then the 10% of the time when we can't find even a literal one, it's like, well, what's the time period of this story?
Yeah. Or like, we're like, where, what state did this happen in?
Exactly. What state did it happen in? Exactly. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I love that. Well, yeah, thank you again for coming on. And
of course.
Speaking of our cocktail segments, both of our cocktail segments, let's dive into some cocktail history.
I can't wait. I feel like I'm in
honored.
The room where it happened, the room where it happened.
Yes.
That's how I feel right now.
Amazing.
I like this is like a kind of fangirl moment for me. Cocktail segment. Here we go.
I love it. I wish we could all be here together in person so that I could make the cocktails for you.
We do too.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do too.
when Stephanie and I were both still in Brooklyn and we're recording in person, that was like my favorite thing to like make a cocktail. I don't mind doing something super like fancy and complicated because I'm the one that has to make it. Mm-hmm. But so because there's four different people in four different places today, I decided to keep it pretty simple.
We appreciate it.
Yeah.
And then just let us know when you're having a housewarming party and making us all cocktails, and we'll be
course.
There.
Yeah. Yeah. We're having a holiday party. Well, we'll cut this out of the episode, but we're having a holiday party on Friday. Hop a plane and come on over.
On Friday and be back on Saturday. Definitely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely.
We have a guest room. It's fine.
That's awesome.
Okay. Where was I? So yeah, the cocktail we are drinking today is basically as simple as they come. There's two ingredients. We're drinking a Greyhound today, which is just grapefruit juice and vodka in a glass with some ice. That's all there is to it. We know when it comes to the history of the Greyhound that the first time there was like a published recipe for a cocktail, even kind of similar with grapefruit juice and clear spirit, was in 1930 in Harry Craddock's Savoy cocktail book. But this recipe was not called a Greyhound, and it wasn't actually made with vodka. It was made with gin, but it's very similar. This is the first time a similar recipe appeared. And actually, I guess sometimes some people do make Greyhounds with gin today, but I've never had a gin one. So we have talked about this on the show before, but vodka wasn't really a thing outside of Russia before the Russian Revolution. And even afterward, it took a few decades for it to really become popular, especially in the US and in Europe. So it took a while. We weren't there yet in the 1930s, but by 1945, Harper's Magazine published a recipe for a Greyhound. And this one was made with vodka. But here's where things get interesting. When I started researching this, I was like, there's two ingredients. This cocktail is going to be so boring. There's nothing to it.
Totally.
But there actually is a very interesting fact that I just like, it didn't come up in the first couple articles I was looking at. And then I found it. I was like, oh my God.
Wow. You are a true history podcaster. Just kept going down the rabbit hole.
Yes, I know. Just for a cocktail a cocktail with two ingredients in it. I'm like, I got to keep looking. There's got to be something. So apparently the Greyhound bus line used to have a chain of restaurants called Greyhound Post House that were located in Greyhound terminals so that people that were traveling didn't have to leave the bus station to go get something to eat if they had like a layover in a certain city or whatever. So when Harper's published their Greyhound recipe in 1945, they actually wrote that the recipe was popular at these Post House restaurants. And that's why they called it a Greyhound.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, because it's like, so this cocktail, this is actually one of my favorite cocktails ever. It's named after a bus.
I love that.
Yeah. So after Harper's published this, they kind of blew up and they became sort of like the signature cocktail for the Post House restaurants. The difference, though, is that at the Post House, they were using canned grapefruit juice. I don't know if you've ever had that, like, canned grapefruit juice that they have at bars.
I think that that's probably what this is made with. Oh. I have, like, a canned version and a fresh version. I actually did squeeze a grapefruit. And that's like the biggest difference I've noticed between the two is the canned version is so intense and yeah. like so like that bitter flavor yes. of grapefruit, but times 20.
Yeah. Mm. So because they were using canned grapefruit, they added sugar to their recipe. Oh, okay. Yeah. But that canned stuff, if you try and drink it on its own, it's so gross.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, I've worked in bars before and like, I was like, oh, I love grapefruit juice. I'm like, oh God, what is that? Yeah. So in the following decades after the recipe was published, they were popular in the Post House, but then in later years, they remained popular thanks mostly to vodka marketing dollars. We have talked about this on the show before as well, but in the 60s and like 70s, most vodka brands had Russian names or Russian sounding names. So a lot of them were really worried about public perception during the Cold War. So they started pouring all of this money into PR and marketing to kind of like get past that like anti-Russian sentiment. And one of their biggest, like most favorite things to do was to find cocktail recipes that were really, really easy to make at home with just a couple of ingredients. So they really pushed the Greyhound in print in like the 70s and 80s. So Greyhounds have been popular for a very long time. And actually, my husband and I served a Greyhound at our wedding as one of our signature cocktails.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah,
we had two signature cocktails and we did one Greyhound, but we added vanilla and rosemary to it just to wedding it up a little bit, gussy it up.
Yeah.
And we called it a little gray dog because our dog at the time, Doris, she's still around, but we have another dog as well now. Yeah. She was our only dog at the time and she was a flower girl and she's a little gray dog.
Oh, that's so sweet.
This. Yeah.
Cute.
Hold our glasses up and see if everybody's looks the same.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
I tried to do a grapefruit, like, what is it? Swirl? What is it called? With the skin of it?
Oh, a twist.
A twist?
Yeah.
It looks pretty sad.
I even have a hard time with the twist sometimes. Yeah. We have like a really good friend who's an actual like fancy bartender.
The fanciest.
I'm always put to shame whenever I watch him make cocktails. I'm like, oh, I could never.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's really, you know, it's very simple, but it's great. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's refreshing, a little bitter, which I love, bright. And of course, because it's vodka, it doesn't really taste like much other than fruit juice.
Right.
Yeah, it is one of my favorite cocktails. Also, one of my favorite things that you two do on your show is that you don't just do a cocktail segment, but you also rate the cocktails every time.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So what would you rate this?
I would rate this probably like a solid 7.
A 7.
That's I was gonna say the same. So it's out of 10.
7 out of 10.
One is
would
vomit
never
worthy,
would never drink it.
Really anything below 5 is a never. I feel like 5 is tolerable.
Right.
And then, so 7 is a pretty solid rating, actually. Okay.
One is like anything with Campari in it.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
That's why I was hesitating. there. What I wanted to say was anything with Campari, vermouth, or gin in it is what I wanted to say.
But no, but not gin. Because
I know that
now I'm a gin girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want to get myself kicked out of the meeting. So that's why I didn't say what I wanted to say. Yeah, exactly. And goodbye. Because you love Campari, right?
I love it. It's one of my favorites. I know. It's
a
weird one.
How can you love it?
I like things that are kind of bitter and herbal. It's weird. Yeah. It's a weird taste.
Those are my two least favorite tastes. Bitter and herbal.
Yeah, I get it.
It's a little too bitter for me, but I can handle it in small amounts. Like if it's mixed into something and there's not very much of it and there's a lot of something else, I'm like, okay, that's a pleasant bitterness. Right. But when it's like a Negroni is too bitter for me. I can't.
Oh my God.
I love Negronis. I think for us, it's like, even when you have the smallest amount of Campari, it's the only thing that I can taste.
It is powerful.
Yeah. The only thing I can taste, even when it's 10% of the drink, I'm like, oh, this stuff is disgusting.
It was just made in a room with Campari open. You're like,
yeah, Rachel's like, what is this?
Exactly. I can smell it. It's in there.
A Campari LaCroix.
Yeah. It's like Tucks and bananas.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
You don't like bananas? Yeah.
Oh,
I'm not the hugest fan either. And Rachel, we learned this on an episode what was the episode, Rachel?
I remember
Rachel?
This episode.
It was
the Banana Republic.
The Banana Republic.
Yeah. Oh my God, I love bananas. I would literally eat an entire bundle of them right here, right now.
Yeah.
We actually just recorded an episode about Banana Republic at Republics that would have come out, 2 weeks ago today?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so our last full episode was actually just about Banana Republic, so that's perfect fresh in timing. Stephanie's mind that I hate bananas. now that we've all tasted our Greyhounds, I think it's time to let you guys take it away.
We're so excited. So first off, thank you both so much again for having us on the show. We're super thrilled to be here. And after I introduce what the topic is, I'm hoping Tux, you can jump in and kind of explain the relevance of the cocktail. I assume it's just because it's like it was very popular in the 70s.
Yeah, that's basically all it is.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Perfect. Love it. Okay, so we know your podcast, it's all about American political scandals. And while the topic we have brought for you today isn't necessarily political, it is definitely very, very American, and it's very scandalous.
That's
we
perfect.
Are, yeah, I know, perfect. As close as we could get, right? We are bringing to you both the story of the Ford Pinto's explosive history.
Ooh.
Yes.
I'm so excited about this.
For anyone that's not familiar, the 1971 Ford Pinto was rushed into production for a number of reasons that we're going to get into in this episode. But because of this rushed turnaround time, Ford cut a lot of corners. And these corners included selling a car with a fuel tank that Ford knew carried a high risk of setting on fire during rear-end collisions.
That's wild.
Wow. Wild. When Ford conducted a cost-benefit analysis, they found that it would cost them more to fix the car than it would to just pay off all the legal fees that came along with all the wrongful death suits that they received.
That's so messed up.
Mm-hmm. Talk about trapped. American corruption, right? Sounds like something you guys would cover.
Yes, absolutely.
Ford would continue to manufacture this same dangerous model for years, leading to the deaths of approximately 27 people.
Wow.
So I think in true beyond reproach fashion, we need to say a toast before we begin. I like that you guys do this. The toast will, one, be in remembrance of the people that lost their lives as a result of American corruption and capitalism. And two, simply because I think we all are going to need another sip of this drink to get through this episode.
Yes. Yeah. You're so correct.
Cheers to that.
Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers.
All right. Mm-hmm. So before we dig too much into the Ford Pinto, let's do a little background and a little history on subcompact cars. Just what you've all been waiting for. I know.
Woohoo!
So subcompact cars are exactly what they sound like. They're essentially just smaller than compact cars. Today's examples of subcompact cars are like a Honda Fit or a Toyota Prius or a Nissan Versa. Subcompact cars are very common nowadays, but they really didn't get their start in the United States until the 1960s and early 70s due to the increased number of imported subcompact cars from countries like Japan and Germany.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can likely think of a handful of benefits to a subcompact car right off the top of our heads, but particularly at this point in history, during the fuel crisis of the 1970s, the rising cost of fuel had put many people in a position where they couldn't afford to continue to fuel their larger vehicles. Mm-hmm. Sounds kind of familiar.
Yes.
relevance.
Yeah, and a subcompact car with a much smaller fuel tank was obviously more cost effective. So they were growing in popularity for sure. So to compete with the influx of subcompact cars coming from overseas, American motor companies decided they needed to create some subcompact cars of their own. Both AMC and Chevrolet each put out their own versions of the subcompact cars, while Ford Motor Company eventually was like, yeah, we should get on that, I guess, and decided they needed to create one of their own as well.
Yeah. So in 1967, Ford began planning a model that they named the Pinto. They named it after a pony. The president of Ford at the time.
Not the bean.
I was about to say.
No, the pony. Okay. So the president of Ford at the time, he was very particular about both the size and the cost of this vehicle. He was insistent that the vehicle weigh less than 2,000 pounds and that it costs less than $2,000, the equivalent of what is for us today, just over like $14,000.
Okay.
Yeah. And for reference, Leah already mentioned, you know, kind of our modern day equivalent of a subcompact car is a Toyota Prius. So again, for reference, this year's Toyota Prius model weighs roughly 3,000 pounds. Okay. So even with all of today's technologies, our modern day subcompact vehicles generally weigh more than what Ford was attempting to achieve in the 1960s and 70s. So that's just something to keep in mind here.
Yeah.
Some other alarming numbers about this production process is that at a time when it generally took automotive companies roughly 43 months to develop a new car, it took the folks at Ford only 25 months to complete the Pinto. This is the shortest.
Oh, no.
Half the time. This is to date or up to, you know, this point in history. This was the shortest production period in automotive history.
Oh, my gosh.
I feel like that says something.
Yeah. Like, oh.
That's right. Yeah. So that's really encouraging. And it's only going to go down from here, guys.
Oh, no.
Afraid of losing out to their competitors, they rushed the process, often making poor decisions or just not making decisions at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we, of course, already know that there are going to be problems with this vehicle because, well, we teased at them at the intro of the story. And it would have been one thing if the developers of this car were just negligent and the problems arose after the vehicle was already in the hands of the consumers. That would be one thing, right?
Oh, no. Sure.
But that was not the case with the Pinto. Oh. The people at Ford knew up front that they were delivering a dangerous and life-threatening product to the American people, and they went balls to the wall and just went for it anyways.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Is it?
can I interrupt for just a second to ask?
Please.
Were there like manufacturing standards set by the government at this point, or is this sort of like?
There were, but they were nowhere as strict as they are today.
And okay. Are they stricter today because of this car?
This is one of the many reasons. Okay. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
So this car, like, it made the safety standards of the day back then.
I mean, yes, essentially.
Wow. That's terrifying.
It certainly led to a lot of the safety standards that we have today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It was during the development process when they were doing a car collision test that they found that there was an issue with the design of the fuel tank. So let's take a moment here to do a terrifying exercise I like to call, yeah, humans really are that crazy. So this is a visualization exercise, okay? So close your eyes and picture this common occurrence for most of us. We hop into our cars in the morning. We start up that engine. We ignore that low tire pressure light that's been on for, you know, like a week straight. And we drive our imperfect machines that have highly, highly flammable liquid in them onto the freeway. I myself am in California, so I obviously go 10 to 15 miles per hour over the speed limit.
Yeah.
And I'm surrounded by other highly flammable machines being driven by even more imperfect humans also ignoring the speed limit, and just continue to ignore the imminent and likely danger we put ourselves in every day. We all do it. Yeah, you're welcome. I just wanted to put it out there. We all get into these very dangerous vehicles that have flammable fluids in them, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm mostly kidding here, mostly, because generally fuel tanks have been designed to be like stowed away in a not particularly accessible location, and they're kept in a confined space that's unlikely to be damaged even in the event of a collision. Mm-hmm. But in the 1971 Ford Pinto, they chose to position the fuel tank elsewhere. And we have a picture for us to look at and discuss the location of their fuel tank.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the first picture we sent over. I am not a car person at all, but I can tell you.
Is that bad. the like thing with the sort of like cross grain sort of in the back, in like in the bumper?
Yeah.
In the back.
No.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
What a terrible, why would you do that?
That's really bad.
It's really bad. The fuel tank was positioned behind the rear axle, right there at the rear bumper, as you can see. If you were to be in a rear end collision, which we all know are some of the most common, if not the most common types of collisions, that tank could very easily be damaged. And obviously
horrific.
It's horrific. And again, this is us like not car people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knowing that that is a bad idea.
Totally.
Like, wow. Your fuel tank is one of the last things that you want to be damaged in your vehicle. And Ford knew that this was a problem. They discovered this problem during the development process, and yet they chose not to fix it.
Oh my God.
After they did a cost benefit analysis and they discovered that it would cost them $11 per vehicle, which is the equivalent of $80 in today's money. $80.
What?
They determined that it was simply too much additional money to throw at these cars. This major American corporation, $11, $80, that's just simply too much. Their analysis showed that it would be cheaper for the company to fight off lawsuits and pay damages than to put an extra $11 toward each one of these vehicles.
That is unbelievable.
That truly is.
It is. The motto at Ford at that time, this is not a direct quote, this is just me assuming, is money talks, human lives don't.
We're cutting costs by cutting corners.
Wow. It's bad.
And like $11, you're so like,
it's nothing.
You're so insistent that it not be more than $2,000, but if you charge people $2,011,
right,
that would be fine.
Right. I think
even round up, just 2020.
Yeah.
You know,
a great year and a great car.
I'm not trying to justify this. It's horrible. But I think when it just goes to show the corruption of these companies and that money is what talks, because in our minds, $5 is not that much. But to pay off all these people that die, it's going to cost you $3 instead. Subtract 2 times that by how many ever people die, it ends up making more financial sense to Ford Motor Company.
That is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. It's horrendous. Now, obviously unaware of these dangers, the American people, they gobbled up what Ford was marketing as their, quote, little carefree car. I mean, I think of it today. I know.
Not their little carefree car. That explodes. I know
that marketing is kind of like a slap in the face, I would say.
Yeah.
I think of it today, you know, as the equivalent of a fuel efficient 5-passenger sedan for roughly $14,000. That sounds like a pretty good deal. And the American people at this time thought so too. In fact, in the first year on the market alone, Ford sold more than 300,000 of these cars. Now, as we, of course, know, the success would not last for long. Unrelated to the fuel tank issue that we know, of course, is going to arise, there were also tens of thousands of recalls due to issues with the accelerator and hundreds of thousands of recalls due to engine air filter issues. They cut all the corners.
That's 24 months of what was it? 24 months?
25.
25 months of manufacturing or whatever.
That's unbelievable.
Right.
Okay, but in relation to the fuel tank issues specifically, One of the most devastating incidents to occur as a result of the poor Pinto manufacturing took place in 1972, only 1 year after the car hit the market. A woman named Lily Gray, along with 13-year-old passenger Richard Grimshaw, was merging her new Ford Pinto onto the freeway. Her car stalled for whatever reason, and as a result, a vehicle coming up behind her at approximately 30 miles per hour rear-ended her. Immediately, this collision burst the fuel tank in the Pinto, sparking a fire. Gray and Grimshaw were able to get out of the vehicle, but not before being consumed by flames. Oh, Gray would end up dying hours later as she lay in the emergency room of a local hospital. And Grimshaw would fortunately survive the horrendous incident, but not unscathed. He suffered severe burn injuries, so severe that he had to undergo numerous surgeries, including grafts for his ears and nose using skin from uninjured areas of his body. At only 13 years old, Grimshaw was forever disfigured from this horrible incident.
That's horrific. Oh my God.
Both the Gray family and Grimshaw family would end up filing separate lawsuits against the Ford Motor Company. Eventually, the jury would award more than $2 million to the Grimshaws and more than $500,000 to the Grays. Ford would also be punished with $125 million in punitive damages. Ford then had the gall to appeal this judgment. Court actually ended up reducing the punitive damages to $3.5 million. So it went from $125 million to $3.5
million. That's unbelievable.
Despite getting off what I think we all agree was relatively easily, this trial would be the beginning of the end for the Ford Pinto.
Good.
Okay. Yeah. I think this is a great place to take a little break. Let's refresh our cocktails if we need to. We'll hear a quick message and we'll be right back.
I'm Natalie.
And I'm Cass.
And we're the hosts of Shared History,
a comedic history podcast exploring the stories of the often overlooked or underrepresented.
The people and events your history books may have glossed over, whitewashed, man-washed, or left out completely.
From the Mayan creation myth to the Deaf President Now movement of the 1980s.
From ancient scientist Avicenna to first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller.
If you saw it in a footnote once,
or have never heard of it,
we are here to share it with you.
Join us in a rotating guest list featuring scholars, writers, teachers, entertainers, entrepreneurs, subject matter experts, and more.
Tune in to Shared History on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, you know the drill.
And follow us at Shared Pod on Instagram and Twitter.
And as always,
share you later.
So as I know Leah and I've seen time and time again in our studying of history, and I'm sure that both of you can agree to this too, I think of namely our episodes where we covered MK Ultra or the Watergate scandal. Despite there being an awareness about the issues at hand, it's only because of the media and determined investigative journalists that the issues were cast into such a bright light that they just couldn't be ignored.
Yeah.
The same year that the Grays and the Grimshaws won their lawsuit, the Mother Jones magazine issued a scathing expose on the Ford Pinto. They titled it Pinto Madness. And if anyone is interested, we don't have the picture here to show you all, but you can very quickly and easily just Google Pinto Madness Mother Jones. And it's just this like extremely dramatic, exaggerated magazine cover of this woman screaming in a car that's just burst
on
into
fire.
Flames.
Holy cow. Wow.
Now, this article in the Mother Jones magazine, it would allege all the things. It would allege that the hostile and tense work environment at Ford had made the manufacturers feel like they couldn't express their concerns about the vehicle, that, you know, a memo had been developed that distinctly showed the cost-benefit analysis where the Ford company put a price tag on human lives, Ford knew that the Pinto was, quote, a fire trap, unquote, and the Pinto,
Wait, was that also, their quote?
So Mother Jones was alleging that Ford was referring to the Pinto as a fire trap. which we're going to get into the Mother Jones article a little bit more, kind of its accuracy. But I mean, who's to say that maybe there weren't a couple people at Ford referring to this vehicle as a fire trap?
Mm-hmm. I would not be surprised at all. Yeah,
exactly. Right. Exactly. And then finally, the Mother Jones article said that the Pinto was responsible for the horrendous burning deaths of at a minimum 500 people.
Oh my God.
Right. Now, while this expose was exactly what the country needed to wake up to the harms of the Pinto and the Ford Motor Company as a whole, unfortunately, much of the material contained in the article would be at the least a gross exaggeration and at the most entirely false. Such misleading piece of information to come from the Mother Jones article was that Pinto memo that I mentioned. So this is the second picture that we sent over. I want you just to look at it. Don't feel like you have to read it necessarily, but just kind of to give the listeners an idea of what you're looking at here.
So it's sort of just a list of like numbers and costs and deaths versus, oh boy, like legal fees, like what they would have to pay out versus the cost of, what is this, a fixing? Oh yeah, $11 per car. The total cost of fixing everything. Oh my God. So they're saying the benefits they would have to pay out for lawsuits would be like $50 million, just under $50 million. But to fix everything, it would be $140 million.
Right. Oh, it's horrendous that this is documented.
Wow. Yeah. So this was a memo from Ford Motor Company.
And this one is real.
This is real.
Okay.
Oh, this memo is real. So what we see here is clearly it's bad enough, but what the Pinto Madness article, what they alleged was that this memo had been put together prior to production of the vehicle. It alleged that these calculations of values on human lives had been made from the onset, but in reality, this memo was created 2 years after the Pinto was already on the market as an internal means of justifying their refusal to fix the vehicle properly. Still absolutely icky, but like a degree or maybe 2 degrees less so.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely would have been more damning if this was from before, but
horrible,
it's still
horrible.
Yeah,
we're calculating human lives versus $11. So
exactly.
Additionally, the claim of more than 500 deaths as a result of the Ford Pinto fires is entirely unfounded in this article. Unfortunately, the precise number of fatalities caused by the Pinto was really hard to locate in our research, and it was really kind of all over the place, but most sources generally agree that 27 people died as a result of the Pinto fuel tank issue.
Okay. That's a lot less than 500.
Right.
Sure. I mean, that's still 27 too many for sure. Yeah,
exactly.
But,
and how many people were badly burned and like,
that's
disfigured? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. This is only counting people who died. There were obviously more injuries and issues with the Ford Pinto, not even related to the fuel tank issue.
And I would insert again that even though this memo that we saw was produced 2 years after it was on the market to justify why they were continuing to push out this vehicle without doing proper safety protocols, even though that's 2 years later, Ford did know during the development process that there was an issue with the fuel tank. As they were testing it, they knew that there was a tendency for the fuel tank to explode.
I mean, anyone with eyes could see.
Right.
This is a bad place to put the fuel tank.
Yeah, it's not the
non-car people can see that. When you have to lift up your bumper to put gas in, that's a problem.
That is wild.
It's insane. So regardless of the misinformation contained within this magazine article, it set a chain of events into motion, right?
Okay.
So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration would be forced to conduct an investigation after years of attempting to avoid public persecution for their own negligence on the matter. Likely in an attempt to appeal to the general public, the NHTSA ensured that the tests that they conducted as a part of their investigation of the Ford Pinto would 100% prove that the Ford Pinto was dangerous. Mm-hmm. So to ensure this was the final outcome, they ran a rear impact crash test with a large, heavy car that had been loaded with additional weights as opposed to like a standard car you might see on the freeway.
Oh, no.
They also ensured that the fuel tank of the Tess Pinto was entirely filled with fuel, as opposed to the way most folks operate with their gas tank at almost always below half, right?
Mm-hmm. My hand is raised. Yes. Almost always on E, yes.
Yeah.
Naturally, when they rammed this huge car into the back of the Ford Pinto during the crash test, the fuel tank was punctured and led to a giant explosion. Instead of waiting for the NHTSA to force a mandatory recall as a result of these tests, Ford instead chose to voluntarily recall the 1.9 million 1971 to 1976 Pintos.
Okay.
But again, it's after getting public outcry, public attention, totally. Public awareness, right?
Yeah.
Now, I think anyone, any car owners out there are very familiar with this concept, is that when there's a recall on, for example, my seatbelt or something, I might not get the notice of that recall for several months after the other person that owns a Honda Civic received theirs, right? Like, these things kind of mm-hmm. get pushed out in a weird rolling basis. And unfortunately, that was also the case with the Ford Pinto. Not everyone got the memo on these recalls right when they happened. Okay. And so in 1978, just 1 year after the Mother Jones, you know, article was written, and this is also 1 year after the Gray and Grimshaw settlements, three teenage girls were headed to a church volleyball practice in their 1973 Ford Pinto. They were rear-ended on the highway by a large van, and within seconds, the entire car burst into flames.
Oh my gosh.
Two of the young women would die nearly instantly, while the third would die. Yes. And then the third would die the following day at a nearby hospital. Young girls headed to church to play volleyball. Approximately 6 months after the tragic incident, the parents of the deceased teens would receive a notice in the mail from the Ford Motor Company.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
About a recall due to a fuel tank design issue that may or may not lead to an explosion in the course of a rear end collision. Can you even imagine how horrendous, like, even just talking about it, I get goosebumps all over my whole body.
Seriously. Yeah. That is such a, like, slap in the face.
Yes.
To these parents. Oh,
so horrible. A grand jury would end up indicting the Ford Motor Company with three counts of reckless homicide. This would actually be the first time in history that a corporation would be charged with murder.
Good.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
Ford
they
would end up
literally
go
did
ahead.
Murder these girls. Sorry.
Yeah, they did. No, yeah. they did. And you know, if we want to, like, really dive into this really deeply too, I mean, the degree of murder too, because it
absolutely.
Was premeditated. It was, that's what I was almost going to say. It's like they knew this was a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ford would end up being found not guilty.
What?
But a later appeal would force the company to pay $6.6 million.
A pittance, but
in total there would end up being approximately 117 lawsuits brought against Ford in relation to the rear end collision fires. But during the Pinto's short-lived reign, they would sell over 3 million of them.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
So in more recent years, with history's perspective and 2020 hindsight, many researchers have found that although the Ford Pinto is the dangerous subcompact car we all always hear about, mm-hmm. it actually was not the only dangerous one out there. In fact, other subcompact vehicles, including the imports, were just as dangerous at the time.
Yeah.
Oh.
Competition.
Stop it. Wow.
And people were like dying in these accidents too with the Forded cars.
Correct.
Wow.
Okay.
In fact, in 1990, a UCLA School of Law professor named Gary T. Schwartz published an article titled "The Myth of the Ford Pinto Case," in which he proved that the Ford Pinto was no more dangerous than the other subcompact vehicles on the market at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you know if the like fuel tanks were in similar places in some of these other cars?
I knew that was going to be the question. Yeah. And literally my mind was going, let me look up really quickly what other subcompacts. I knew you were going to ask that, because it actually was the first thing that came to my mind right now too. I know that that was a common design element at this time in subcompact cars. I can't confidently say that it wasn't all of these, you know, or Ford was just exceptionally dumb. Okay.
So I guess it's possible at least that like Ford got the idea for this design from some of the other cars that were already popular before they decided to do this.
Right. And I think
in theory, anyways,
in theory, the other thing too is they were the production of subcompact vehicles was in response to the demand for more fuel efficient.
Sure.
So were they
modes
all
of transportation? Go ahead.
Were they all rushing to get these cars to market?
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. Is there none of these companies allowed themselves the time to put forth quality, controlled, safe vehicles?
Capitalism. That's wild.
Yeah. So rather, it was the way that the media villainized the Ford Motor Company above all other motor companies that led to this damaging legacy. Like when people think of the Ford Pinto, they think of it very negatively.
Yeah.
So it took years for Ford to regain the public's trust. For a long time, Ford was seen as a greedy, money-hungry company that put dollar bills above quality. I
mean, unlike all the other companies.
Yeah, unlike.
Didn't care very much about money at all.
Unique to them.
Yeah.
Totally unique, guys.
Yeah.
And particularly above the values of human life, the Ford Pinto has become synonymous with corporate greed and corruption.
Sure. Yeah.
Despite all of this, and despite the fact that the last Pinto model Ford ever released was in 1980, there are people, some weird diehard classic Ford enthusiasts, that still drive Pintos to this day because with a very minor $11 fix, the Pinto runs like a champ.
Do you what is the fix? Do you know,
like moving the fuel tank?
Moving it, okay.
Yeah, you can for $11 in those days or $80 today.
Wow,
that's how much it costs to move the fuel tank into a more safe position.
That's crazy,
unbelievable,
isn't
but
it?
That's all they had to do was move it.
It's unbelievable. That, you guys, is the story of the Ford Pinto. It reminded us. So we did this episode. I believe we may have done it the same season that we put out an episode about the McDonald's hot coffee case and kind of all the misconceptions that there are about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
the coffee was actually really, really, really hot.
It was unbelievably hot.
Yeah. And that person was really hurt. Yeah.
She went through like surgeries for the rest of her life and was like permanently disfigured. Yeah.
And people make jokes about it like, oh, people are too sensitive. And it's like, frivolous, she was badly burned.
Yeah, frivolous lawsuits. Exactly. Yeah. No, it was really, really horrible. Misconceptions for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. And so I'm pretty sure we did them in close concession to one another, which made us, we just kept looking at each other like, oh my God, just the corruption of these American corporations. That same with McDonald's, like the reason why they kept their coffee as hot as they did was because they said it lasted longer. It was fresher for longer, the hotter it was.
Sure.
And but it's the difference of like, how much are McDonald's black coffees? Like a dollar?
Even today, they're $1.50, I think.
Yeah, nothing.
It's like, how much money are you truly losing on $1, $1.50 coffee if you bring it down a little bit and you just have to dump how much out? You have to dump three coffees worth out.
Yeah, you have exactly. Yeah, you have to throw it away 20 minutes earlier or something.
Exactly. Yep. And so it's you know, from our perspective, just kind of the common sense perspective, Ford, it would have cost you $11 to save at a minimum 27 lives. And those are, again, just the people that died, not the people that were injured.
Mm-hmm.
Same with McDonald's. It would cost you, I mean, I don't know the numbers, but I'm going to take a wild guess and say McDonald's loses $10 a day by dumping their coffee 20 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
That's so fucked up. Yeah. Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah, well, disturbing.
Thank you for telling that story. Holy cow.
Yeah.
You're welcome. It feels the same as when we had you on our show for our season finale, where it was like, thanks. Now I'm depressed and I'm going to go curl up in a ball. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, even though it wasn't exactly directly political, there's definitely like we were talking about, like safety standards and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this passed government
regulation
standards and regulations and like, not just the Ford Pinto, but all of these other cars at the time that were just as dangerous.
Right.
That the government was just like, it's fine.
Right.
And
it's wild.
Yeah.
Ford says it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing that makes it the most mind-blowing to me, I think even if we were to say this car is going to cost an additional $1,000 to make it a safe vehicle. We all would agree $1,000 more to save a human life. Exactly. Obviously, that's worth it. Yeah. But then when you say $11,
I cannot.
It's just, it's mind blowing.
Literally.
For a company like Ford.
Yeah.
Who is one of the most well-known American corporations for their wealth. Mm-hmm. The fact that they couldn't dish out 11 additional dollars.
I can't. So I
can't fathom it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask, I don't know if you know this or not, mm-hmm. but when the cars were recalled, did they just take the cars back or did they fix the placement of the gas tank?
Did they spend the $11 in Uber?
They discontinued them. Okay. Ford Pinto got discontinued. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's why there's still like a few stragglers out there. Like Leah was mentioning, there are still people that drive Ford Pintos. I don't know the stats of that. I don't know if it's like 2 people or 20 people. But
I love my Pinto.
Exactly. Yeah. But there are some diehard classic Ford fans that again, for like, it would cost me, if I had a Ford Pinto, $80 today to say, hey, could you move the fuel tank? That'd be great.
$80 plus $300 for labor.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, right.
In that case, never mind. I'll just be really, really, really careful. Yeah. I'll put bubble wrap around the bed.
Oh my gosh. What are they called? Bumper buddy? I don't know if that's
Yep.
Everyone in New York has those. So
really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I can imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. It's so bad.
That is a wild story. I mean, I feel like, you know, now when cars are recalled for safety things, usually they just want to fix it and give it back to you. But of course, those recalls aren't surrounded by all this unbelievable, terrible press too. So it makes sense that they were just like, no, just give me the car back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was trying to remember. Yes. Again, I keep like, I don't know what the word is I want, streamlining or putting together McDonald's and Ford, and they're not the same company, but they're just both huge American corrupt corporations. And so I just kind of wanted to look at the time difference. And so this whole thing that was going on with the Ford Pinto was in the 70s and the McDonald's hot coffee case was in the mid 90s. Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, not the same company, not run by the same people, but it's just crazy that kind of the thought process.
Yeah. Same
doesn't
concept.
Change. Same concept.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, corporations are going to corporation. The capitalists are going to capitalist.
Corporations are going to, I like that. Corporations are going to corporation.
It's profits over people, and it always will be, unless the government is there to step in and be like, no, you can't do that, you know?
Yeah.
It's wild.
Oh, wow.
And unfortunately, the government didn't step into this, even though they were somewhat complicit in it, until there was so much negative press and you know, word of mouth going around about it that they had to. So
Jeez,
a salacious and mostly inaccurate article, that's all it took.
That's all it takes.
That's a shame about how they lied in this article.
It is, because it's like, kind of what Tux was saying is like the difference between 27 deaths and 500, like that is obviously a huge difference. But if I read that there was a vehicle on the road, on the market, that could easily be fixed and it had killed more than 2 dozen people, that's enough for me.
Same. Yeah, absolutely.
It doesn't have to be a triple digit number.
Yeah, there's no reason to do all that.
No.
But I guess, you know, they want to sell papers too. This is all still comes back to capitalism and
totally.
But, you know, it's weird because I think of Mother Jones as sort of like super reputable.
I think they've come a ways.
Yeah.
Okay. Because if you are interested in Googling Mother Jones, Ford, what is it called? Ford Madness.
Pinto Madness.
Pinto Madness. Thank you. I'm trying to get the picture up. Yeah. Mother Jones, Pinto Madness. It was the first picture that came up. It's just like such a wild picture too.
Yeah. It almost reminds me of those, like, what was it? Like Mad Magazine.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Definitely.
Like cartoony kind of covers. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I'm looking it up now.
Yeah.
Oh. Right? Yeah. She is. Yeah. Are you driving the deadliest car in America?
Right.
Whoa.
Wild. Okay. Yeah, we're going to have to put that on our Instagram.
And if you need me to send you anything else, let me know.
Okay. Yeah, we'll do that. Well, thank you guys so much for telling that story and continuing our tradition of horribly depressing everyone who likes to listen to us.
Certainly. It's right. What we do. Love to.
Same. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
You guys did a great job.
Yes. Yeah.
Lived up to the reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I feel like Stephanie's like one of her favorite things to do on our show is conspiracies.
Yes.
So I do. I feel like this is like meat and potatoes too.
It's adjacent to the mess that I love.
Yes.
The thing I love about, and I obviously I use the word love lightly because this is a tragic and horrendous story, yes. Right? But I guess what I love about these types of stories is that I would never see myself as someone that spent 2 weeks researching Ford Pintos or whatever, totally. Right? Like, yeah. But it's that underlying wild story that captures us, right? That's fascinating. Same with, we did a whole episode about the racist history of the Masters tournament, the golf Masters tournament. Did I ever see myself as like researching the Masters tournament? Absolutely not. Nope. But that was fascinating to learn the history behind it and the through line of why there's still such racist sentiments in the golf industry today. That's the neat thing about history, is even these like obscure topics that I never would have thought I'd have any interest in. If there's corruption and conspiracy in there, you got me.
And there usually is. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Always is. Yeah.
Yeah.
You just got to keep looking.
What you're interested in. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You'll find it if you just dig hard enough.
Wait, a man was in charge? Let me keep looking. Yes.
There's something messed up in this story for sure.
Amazing.
But yeah, I guess, are we done? My drink is...
Yeah, I just finished.
Mine's almost done. Mm-hmm. Now my drink is empty.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess we're done. America's history is juicy. We just add vodka and some grapefruit juice.
That's all you need.
Yes.
Real simple. Thank you so much again to the ladies of hashtag history for coming in and telling this really amazing story.
Seriously. And thank you.
It was so
thank
good.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
Yeah.
Do you have anything you guys want to
plug? Yeah. It was totally about to forget that.
Do you want to talk about your socials? Tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find us on Instagram at #history_podcast. And we're also on TikTok now at #history.
That's it.
All one word. Mm-hmm. And our website is #history-pod.com.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
This was so much fun.
Yeah, yeah, it really was. It's wild how much fun that we, every time we have guests on, or if it's just me and Stephanie, it's unbelievable that we are able to find a way to enjoy these horrific stories.
I know. That's really every episode for us.
Yeah.
Same. I'm like, I feel, it's part of me feels kind of bad.
It's the vodka.
Yeah, the vodka helps for
be
sure.
Honest.
Yeah.
The vodka.
Yeah. Kind of necessary for what we do.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally. So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
Rachel.
And Leah.
Yes.
Amazing. Thank you to our new audio editor, Dev. We cannot do this without him. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Thank you guys.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. And make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you're not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.